It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll hear from a former UW men's basketball player who says it's time to start paying college athletes. First, it's time for our week in Washington. Yesterday was Election Day, and though odd-year elections have less going on than even-numbered years, both parties are looking for lessons in yesterday's results. Eyes were on Virginia and New Jersey in particular. They both elected governors and a lot of state lawmakers. Democrat Ralph Northam was elected governor of Virginia, and Phil Murphy, also a Democrat, won the race for governor in New Jersey. President Trump loomed large in both states and elsewhere. In his victory speech, Governor-elect Murphy in New Jersey made his stance on Trump clear.
We will stand firm for New Jersey's values and push back against the mean winds blowing at us from Washington, D.C. This is one of the first major elections since Donald Trump was elected. Tonight, New Jersey sent an unmistakable message to the entire nation. We are better than this.
Harry Enten is a senior political writer and analyst for 538.com. Harry, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, since last year, around this time, Democrats have been looking for some unambiguously good news in election results. Did they finally find it last night?
I think they've come as close as they've gotten so far. I mean, these were huge wins for Democrats across the board. And while, you know, we're talking about the governor's races, as you mentioned, there were also down ballot races where they did very well, both Virginia, New Jersey, in a New York state, and even across the country in a Washington state where they took control of the state Senate there.
Yeah, that Virginia House of Delegates, I don't think that's on the national radar for most people, but I don't think anybody, Democrats included, expected them to do as well as they did in that set of down-ballot races. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that body has been controlled by Republicans for a long while, and, you know, one of the people who writes for my website, 538, Dave Wasserman, who's a contributor there, and he knows Virginia better than anybody else, said that this would be safe GOP. There was no shot that the Democrats had to take control. And as of this hour, they are within a recount of taking control of that body. It's probably going to end up as a tied body or maybe Republicans with a one-seat advantage. But the idea that it was even close is something unforeseen just 24 hours ago.
Let's look at polling in that Virginia governor's race. It looked like a tight race. It ended up being not so tight. People had said running up like, polls were wrong. The error last time turned out to be underestimating Donald Trump. In a lot of cases, it's going to be the same thing. It's going to benefit Republicans this time. You don't buy that as a general rule.
I mean, boy, will we ever learn our lesson when it comes to this? I mean, polls are good for getting a good understanding when going into the election of what might happen. But keep in mind that there are margins of error, and those margins of error can go either way. It was just 5 years ago when Barack Obama, although he was forecasted to win by the polls, won by a wider-than-expected margin. That is, the polls underestimated Democrats. Then I heard in 2016 from Democrats, oh, the polls are underestimating Hillary Clinton. But in fact, it was just the opposite. And then this year, because the polls underestimated Donald Trump last year, I heard, oh, the polls are underestimating Ed Gillespie, the Republican candidate for governor in Virginia, when in fact they underestimated Ralph Northam, the Democratic candidate for governor. We just need to stop with trying to guess which way the polling errors are going to go. Polls are a good gauge for where the public is, and they don't, at least in the long run, tend to underestimate either side.
And Harry, a lot of people are going to try to draw lessons from yesterday, Republicans, Democrats, pundits, what have you. Before we get into potential lessons, do we put too much weight on the most recent election, whether it's 2008, 2010, 2016, or yesterday?
I mean, of course. I think we always try to gauge too much from any one or two elections that happened recently. And the fact of the matter is, over the long term, what we see is pretty much equal balance between Democrats and Republicans, right? George Bush was in there for two terms, then Barack Obama was in there for two terms, and now we have Donald Trump. The fact of the matter is that we're a 50-50 nation, and it just matters when exactly you land on the dial to see whether it's Democrats or Republicans in charge.
We're looking at the week's top national political news with Harry Enten from 538, focusing a lot on yesterday's election results. Harry, Donald Trump's lesson in a tweet, quoting here, "Ed Gillespie worked hard but did not embrace me or what I stand for. Don't forget Republicans won 4 out of 4 House seats. With the economy doing record numbers, we will continue to win even bigger than before." So the lesson is Ed Gillespie didn't hail to the Trump enough, and that's why he lost.
Yeah, I'm going to disagree with the president on this one, and I'll also point out that his statement's actually false insofar as that Democrats, in fact, won a special House race in California. Jimmy Gomez held on to that seat for Democrats, so in fact they were 4-for-5 at that point, although now they're 5-for-6 because a Republican won a special House race out in Utah. John Curtis held that seat for the Republicans. But overall, I would just say, you know, if you looked at how the results broke down in the state of Virginia, what you see is Ralph Northam basically capitalizing most in the areas in which Hillary Clinton outperformed Barack Obama just 4 years ago. That is that there was even more of an anti-Trump sentiment in the northern part of the state, where Trump's approval ratings are just basically in the gutter. And Ed Gillespie tried his best. I mean, Ed Gillespie is an establishment Republican who really, I don't think, felt comfortable tying himself to Trump, but certainly put many ads on the air that suggest that he and Trump were tied at the waist. And it just didn't work for him. If anything, I think this is a repudiation, at least in the state of Virginia, of the Trump brand.
And that's the key phrase there, at least in the state of Virginia. Are there lessons here for Republicans elsewhere in the country? Maybe a state like Wisconsin, with currently total Republican control of the governor's office and the legislature, looking at elections next year, about how they treat the whole Trump factor?
I think there are two different parts of this. Number one, we should point out that Virginia, demographically speaking, has a higher percentage of white voters with a college degree than almost any other state in the nation. It's very well educated in the northern part of the state, and obviously that is the group of people, whites with a college degree, among whom Trump does worse compared with prior Republicans. So we have to keep that in mind. That being said, we also saw Gillespie do a little bit worse in a lot of the areas that had high percentages of whites without a college degree, even if he didn't do, say, as poorly as in the areas with whites with a college degree. And more than that, when we look at elections across time, we really do see that the tide towards the Democratic Party is appearing in many different seats that have many different demographics, and not just in Virginia and not just in seats where there are a lot of white voters with a college degree.
And how about younger voters and minority voters and how they turned out?
Well, what we saw, at least, you know, it's a little difficult to tell in terms of age, but the exit polls do suggest that younger voters did turn out, even if not at the same levels as in presidential campaigns. But more than that, they overwhelmingly voted for Ralph Northam, the Democratic candidate. So it's not just necessarily about turnout. It's also how those people are casting their votes. And they went overwhelmingly for Ralph Northam, even more so than they went for Hillary Clinton just last year, and certainly more so than they went for the Democratic candidate Terry McAuliffe for governor 4 years ago in 2013. In terms of minority voters, black voter turnout did seem to be down, which is following a pattern that we've seen in other special elections this year, where the anti-Trump sentiment seems to be strongest among whites with a college degree, that part of the Democratic base, and not necessarily African-American voters.
Now, on the Democratic side, for lessons learned here, one thing people have pointed toward in those delegate races, Democrats ran a lot more candidates, contested a lot more Republican incumbents than they had in the past. Is the lesson you can't win if you don't play?
I think that's exactly the lesson. I think the lesson going into 2018, if you're a Democrat, is you've got to put up candidates everywhere. You never know where you might be able to take advantage of a weak incumbent, or for some reason an anti-Trump sentiment pops up. You need to run candidates all over the place, and that's just the lesson we saw in Virginia last night, and it's one we've seen throughout this year, where Democrats are mostly winning in those places where there are whites with a college degree, but sometimes, unexpectedly, they're winning in some places you wouldn't necessarily think that they would be able to.
Harry Enten's a senior political writer and analyst for 538. He's recapping the top stories in politics for our weekly look at national news. You can share your thoughts now at 800-642-1234. What do you think of these results yesterday? Is President Trump and his approval rating affecting elections so far? Do you think he's going to be a key factor in the midterm elections next year around the country here in Wisconsin? Do you see signs of a Democratic comeback or not? call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now we're talking to Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst at 538. We're looking at the top national news stories. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of yesterday's election results? Is there a Democratic wave coming? What do Democrats need to do in 2018 here in Wisconsin and elsewhere? What do Republicans need to do? Should candidates embrace Donald Trump or keep him at arm's length? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Harry, before we move away from elections, Alabama is coming up next month, this special Senate election. People are wondering if there are lessons from Virginia, but Alabama isn't Virginia. What do you make of that?
Yeah, Alabama is certainly not Virginia. It's a state where the voting is much more racially polarized. And more than that, it's a state where Donald Trump is still relatively popular. It's a state where his approval rating is above his disapproval rating, which is the opposite of how it was in Virginia. And if you look at the governor's results, at least according to the exit polls, pretty much everyone who approved of Donald Trump's job voted for the Republican. Pretty much everyone who disapproved of Donald Trump's job voted for the Democrat in Virginia. If that pattern holds in Alabama, which it probably will for the most part, Republican Roy Moore is probably going to win that race over Democrat Doug Jones. But it's a relatively close race for Alabama. Probably is going to be 10 points or so if you believe the polling averages right now. But it looks for now, at least, that Republicans will hold on there.
And then looking ahead to 2018, Harry, you've written, a lot of people have noted that the opposite party from the president in these off-year elections tends to do pretty well. What, based on what we know now, knowing it's a year off, what are we looking at right now?
I think that we're certainly looking at Democrats doing very, very well in the midterms, at least in the House of Representatives. We're all 435 seats are up for grabs. They'll almost certainly, based upon historical patterns, receive more votes than the Republicans do. The question is whether or not those votes are allocated in the right seats to overcome the Republicans' natural advantage in terms of geographic sorting and gerrymandering in order to get to the 218 seats they need to take control. But right now, I think if you ask most experts, they'd say it is more likely than not that Democrats will take control, but we have a long way to go, and there's a lot of uncertainty around that estimate.
I want to move on to a couple other stories. We may check back in on election news, too. But Kentucky Senator Rand Paul attacked by a neighbor last Friday, worse than initially reported, 5 broken ribs, bruises to his lungs. You tweeted, Harry, that this should be a bigger story than it is. This, once upon a time, an assault on a U.S. senator would have been the top news in the country for a while. What do we know about this?
Well, this is a very weird story, and, you know, I'm afraid to get too far into, you know, what exactly happened. Given that we've gotten some conflicting news reports, most of the mainstream media believes or has argued that it was over a landscaping dispute with stuff around the properties. Remember, these two men were neighbors. He and a fellow doctor were neighbors. So it could have to do with landscaping, though it should be pointed out that there was a story that came out in the past few hours that suggested that Paul, in fact, was a model neighbor and really didn't have any landscaping problems. So it's unclear exactly why this neighbor attacked Rand Paul. Rand Paul didn't do anything wrong. He was there. He was getting off of his lawnmower. He had earbuds on, so he couldn't hear the guy coming. So Rand Paul did nothing wrong, but I think there's still some question as to what this guy's motivation exactly was, and I think that that's something that we'll be able to find out over the next weeks and months ahead as a criminal investigation takes place.
And on this idea that this has been crowded out by a lot of other stories, big stories, but this is something that maybe didn't get as much attention as it usually would.
I think, you know, one of the most interesting facets, or maybe disturbing, depending on your point of view, over the year of the Trump administration that has occurred so far is that normally stories that would sound almost insane get pretty much pushed to the back of the news because there's something else that's newsworthy. Now, that's partially, obviously, a reflection of our 24-hour news cycle, but I think it's also a reflection of the fact that, you know, the Trump administration or Donald Trump can tweet something out and push it completely to the back page, or there could be an election that comes up. But for me, this is a story that should at least get attention because obviously we don't want United States senators, no matter their party, getting attacked on their own property.
And then one of the stories, sadly, that did gain more attention was this the shooting at a church in Texas. A lot of details out about that, Harry, but I want to talk to you about polling on gun control issues after that shooting and before, for that matter. What do we know?
Well, you know, this is one of the issues whereby, you know, the public on individual gun control legislation pieces of issues such as background checks, universal background checks, are overwhelmingly in favor of those, including the vast majority of Republicans. But I've always been of the opinion that individual polling doesn't really get at what people necessarily think. They tend to follow their party when it comes to gun control. And Republicans at this point, no matter what tragedy seems to occur, don't seem that they want to put forward any pieces of legislation. Remember, there was talk about bump stocks after the Las Vegas massacre. Nothing really occurred on that, despite some Republican members of Congress saying that they wanted to move. So I am very hesitant to say that really anything will occur in Congress, despite perhaps what some of the initial reflections are from some of the different members in the House of Representatives of either party.
Talking to Harry Enten from 538.com, looking at the top national news. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you support wider background checks? What's your reaction to the elections yesterday? What does it mean for either party? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. I saw, and I can't remember where, Harry, something about in the exit polls in Virginia yesterday, looking at how important guns were as an issue for people. It was pretty important, but it looks like for people who guns were important to, check me if I had this wrong, they split evenly between the two candidates for governor in Virginia.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the issues. Gun control has been a fascinating issue over a number of years, because normally I believe that the conventional wisdom is that gun control is more important to Republicans than it is to Democrats. But in the exit poll, as you pointed out, 49% among the 17% who said gun policy was the most important issue for their vote for governor, 49% voted for Ralph Northam, the Democrat, 49% voted for Ed Gillespie, the Republican. So it's split evenly. Now, maybe if they phrased it a little differently, we might have gotten, you know, a different answer. But the fact is that there are a lot of Democrats who want gun policy to change in this country. And I'm not necessarily sure, heading into the midterms, as Democrats already have a lot of momentum in other issues, that this is not an issue that tends to break more evenly than perhaps we're used to seeing.
And looking at the Democratic Party, since you brought that up, coming into the Virginia election in particular, it seems like in the last week, a lot of Democrats were getting ready to blame their governor candidate, Northam, for how he was going to lose yesterday. They're really gearing up for failure and this whole center moderate versus liberal Bernie Sanders wing split. Does that quiet down now after this election in Virginia?
I would think it should quiet down. I think that this is a problem that occurs in both parties. Whenever they lose an election, they're always afraid that they're going to lose the next election as well, and there's always intra-party fighting. If anything, right now, the Republican Party having all of its intra-party fighting, despite the fact that they had been winning elections, is the unusual thing that has occurred. But I do think that after winning this election, Ralph Northam has perhaps quieted down some of the anti-establishment forces within the Democratic Party, saying, hey, if only we had run further to the left, you know, we would have won. Ralph Northam was a pretty moderate guy in the state of Virginia, a guy who voted for George W. Bush twice. So I do think that this is the type of victory that establishment Democrats have been kind of looking for, to say to the base, hey, we've got this. We have everything under control. And so I think that this type of overwhelming victory, nearly by double digits, is exactly the type of thing that's going to do that.
And we're just a year out from that big presidential election last year, Harry. We had this revelation from Donna Brazile, as she was interim head of the DNC, talking about this funding arrangement between Hillary Clinton and the National Democratic Party. I think raising old wounds that a lot of Democrats didn't want to raise a week before yesterday's elections. What did you make of the fallout from that?
Yeah, well, I you know, it's very interesting because Donna Brazile is an old party hand. You know, she ran Al Gore's campaign in 2000. She obviously led the DNC last year after Debbie Wasserman Schultz stepped down under a cloud of, we'll say, scandal. But Donna Brazile has never, in my opinion, really been a big fan of the Clintons. You know, in 2008, it's pretty well known that she was behind Barack Obama in that primary over Hillary Clinton. And so, you know, I think that, you know, victory has, a million fathers, I think it is, while defeat is an orphan. and defeat always wants to get blamed at somebody else's feet. And I think that this is an example of that. I think that a lot of Democrats are probably just done with the Clintons and probably just done with Donna Brazile in general, and probably were not too happy over Brazile raising the issues that she did in that book. And I'm not quite sure exactly what she was trying to do, but at the end of the day, I think it's probably what people who are often trying to sell books do, and that is raise the press and raise the controversy so she can sell some books.
And Harry, we slice and dice demographics after elections, and it seems like there's always, you know, 1 year it was the soccer moms, 1 year it was the angry white males. After last year, it was the non-college educated white voters. Now people are looking at the suburban educated voters. Do we play too much into that? This is the one to focus on now.
I think we're always focusing too much on the new here and now group. You know, again, if you look at the results in the race in Virginia, the gubernatorial results, and you compare it to the vote last year, in fact, what we saw was a pretty much a straight lineup with how the votes occurred last year, except everything was shifted a little bit left. That is that Ralph Northam did a little bit better than Hillary Clinton in pretty much every county and independent city. So it wasn't just that, oh my God, Ralph Northam was able to drive up this huge vote in the North. Yes, that was true. But he also did a little bit better, say, than Hillary Clinton did in Lee County down in the southwest part of the state. So, you know, I do think that we try and drill too much down into this. The end of the day, what's most important is getting more votes than the other candidate. And usually it's a lot of different groups that drive that, not just one individual group, not just whites in the suburbs, not just whites without a college degree, as it was last year.
So we've got this Alabama Senate seat up, Harry. Are we done with special elections for a while apart for that?
Yeah, there'll be another. We'll obviously have some state legislative special elections that we always tally up in a sheet and keep an eye out on. And there'll also be a special House election in Pennsylvania coming up in the next few months. But really the focus here on out for the rest of the year is on Alabama. And that's going to be a fun race to watch because that's obviously a state that's very, very different than Virginia and gives us another little slice of understanding how Trump is playing with the American public.
We'll leave it there for now, Harry. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Harry Enten. He's a senior political writer and analyst at 538.com. He joined us for a weekly look at the latest news in national politics. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Antonio Saldana began working in the fields with his family as a migrant worker when he was 4 years old. He tells us about his childhood and becoming the first in his family to graduate high school and then college in Green Bay.
I started working as a migrant worker at the age of 4. Everybody had to work, not just mom and dad, everybody. If you could walk and talk, you were expected to work. The family had been coming to Oconto since the 30s and 40s. We were just there from the middle of July until the second week of September, and then the cucumber harvest would finish, and then you would go to the next state for harvesting another crop. You went to school there in each city that you were at. So you were never there more than 2, 3, 4 weeks. So you didn't make a whole lot of friends because the language barrier, because although we were born, like I was born in Oconto, we were only around the migrant workers. So we could understand English and speak it, but it was very limited. I was doing better academically, and the teachers took an interest in what I had to say. So school was a lot of fun, but then a month before school was out, the students never understood why then I'd be gone, because then I would have to hop on the Greyhound, and you're scared. You're 14. So you get on the bus, and you're on that bus for about 2 days, and then you travel all the way to Torrington, Wyoming, where you're going to Hobetz. The sun was not our friend, he was our enemy. And I used to just look up at the sun and think, oh my gosh, I hate the sun. It is so hot, you know. But we love the rain. If it rained, you didn't have to work. But then there was nothing to do. There was 14 of us. Our shack was only between 24 and 25 feet long and about 14, 16 feet wide. You know the joke, it's so small, I have to go outside to change my mind. That's about the way it was. Well, I always knew I didn't know anything about education because my dad had zero education. My mom only had a fifth grade education. But somehow, like in my mind, I knew this isn't what I want to do and there's a way out. Out of all the Saldanas that we've been here, I am a fourth generation, and I was the first one to graduate from high school. You know, as a school teacher, I just try telling my students, I go, this subject that I teach, Spanish, might not seem important to you, but if you don't like the situation that you're in, education can do this for you. So that the kids want, a lot of the kids had the same dreams that I had, but there's a lot of the children that do that that are trying to get out. But how can you have dreams when you can't even dream? When that sun's beating you, when there's not enough to eat, how can you have dreams? We are not an invisible people. If you went back to the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and early 70s, there was anywhere from 1,400 to 1,600 families at one time in Oconto and Lena, all those places. We were a part of that economical system, and there's nothing there to remember us.
Antonio Saldana is a Spanish teacher in Green Bay. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Now, college athletics is a big business for many universities, often bringing in millions of dollars of revenue annually from ticket sales, merchandising, television contracts, and product endorsements. But the athletes don't get paid, and that's been a growing controversy. It was recently reported that former UW-Madison basketball star Nigel Hayes attempted to organize a boycott of a nationally televised game against Syracuse in 2016. All the players weren't on board, so that boycott never happened. But the subject of paying college athletes remains a hotly debated issue. Zach Bohannon was the captain of the 2014 UW-Madison men's basketball team. He is a supporter of the idea of paying college athletes. Zach, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I appreciate you having me on the show.
And I understand, Zach, that you know when you came to college, came to the team, you didn't like this idea of paying college athletes. What changed your mind?
Yeah, absolutely, and that's a great question. So back in 2011, I was a transfer from the United States Air Force Academy, and I kind of got a glimpse into the eyes of the mid-major type NCAA division of college athletics because I played basketball at the academy. And then I came to Wisconsin, and I was actually in a debate class at Communications 262, actually, at UW-Madison. And I took the side, like any typical fan, that I didn't agree with paying college athletes. They didn't need to get paid for a plethora of obvious reasons. And the more and more I started to debate it, I had to go against the other side. And I started to think with my economics cap on, since I was an economics major, and I started to think that, you know what, this makes no sense. The NCAA is an illegal cartel colluding to not let athletes make their fair share on the free market enterprise system. And so that's ultimately what changed my opinion at that time.
And can you talk about the kind of revenue that's involved in Division I college athletics, the big sports, the football and the basketball in particular?
Absolutely. And the biggest number right now that comes to mind is I just saw a statistic the other day that the athletes, which less than 5%, I think it's like 2 or 3% of them, end up making it to the NFL or NBA and making a chunk of their fair market value at the professionalized sports world. But the NCAA is big business in and of itself. It rivals actually the NFL and billions of dollars generated. It actually generates $13 billion annually by college football and college basketball, which is just incredible.
And as we mentioned Nigel Hayes earlier, can you talk about the kind of activism that you and he did and have done on this issue?
Absolutely. So when I was a junior at Wisconsin, I got one of my teammates was, I don't know how he got involved in it, but he got an email. A monthly email from the National Collegiate Players Association, the NCPA, which was led by a union activist, Ramogi Huma, who actually was a former UCLA football player back in the 90s. And he got this group of players together who just kind of stayed progressively active in what was going on with the NCAA and some of the things that took place. And Jared Bergeron ended up getting me involved and told me, hey, Zach, you should apply or you should get on this email distribution list and end up finding a way to reach out to Romogi. So I ended up reaching out to him. I got on a weekly conference call with some of the other major college football players across the country, and that was kind of what fomented and led to the Northwestern unionization and some of the other things that took place, which ultimately what led me to getting Nigel involved in the lawsuit that he's in.
And yeah, you mentioned that lawsuit. It's not the first, but there have been efforts to unionize at one school and now class action lawsuits. So what are those lawsuits doing?
Yeah, absolutely. So the first lawsuit, which everyone, it kind of became the known lawsuit across the country, was the Ed O'Bannon lawsuit. Was quite frankly, Ed O'Bannon was a National Player of the Year, a basketball player at UCLA back in the late 90s. And he saw his son. He came home from work one day and saw his son playing a basketball game. He's like, "Hey, look, Dad, you're on this video game." And he literally ended up deciding, like, how is that possible that the NCAA can still use his name, image, and likeness without him profiting off of it and not get paid anything in return? So he ultimately sued the NCAA, and that became the name, image, and likeness based on the NCAA saying that they're colluding to not let them use that, which it kind of was a toss-up verdict in the end. It ruled in favor of O'Bannon, but it didn't necessarily make the necessary wholesale changes going forward. The next lawsuit that Romogi Huma had was Jeffrey Kessler, who's a world-renowned antitrust lawyer who actually brought free agency to the NFL, sued the NCAA in regards to saying that it was an antitrust case, that the schools are colluding with one another, in addition with the NCAA, to not let the students make their fair market value. So that's what ultimately Nigel got involved with.
And Zach, in an ideal world, if college athletes got paid, how do you see that working?
For sure. So this is a really touchy subject, and it's hard to get this across, this point of view across to a lot of people. And I still don't necessarily, and this is where the straw man article that the NCAA just throws out there, I go, we're not for pay for play. Well, I'm not necessarily for pay for play either. I don't think college athletes should get paid. They should get paid based on their market rate, and they should be able to use their name, image, and likeness to go off and go sign autographs for or go get their own endorsement deal. At the end of the day, if you're on scholarship as an English major and you write a best-selling novel that sells on Amazon, the English major can make money and profit off of that. If you're a world-renowned engineer who makes a patent who's on a full-ride scholarship, you can still make money off a patent that you make based on your hidden talent or hidden skill that you have. Why should that be any different, and why should it be capped for college athletes just because they're on scholarship and say that that's their fair rate? It's not their fair rate. You see it all the way down the line where all this, like I said, the $13 billion of cash is just getting redistributed to the college coaches, the TV networks, the apparel companies, the schools, the conferences, everyone but the people who is actually doing the real labor.
I want to listen to Nigel Hayes earlier this year on ESPN's Dan Patrick Show. This is from back in March.
Okay, but what do you do if I gave you the opportunity to, you're running the NCAA, you draw it up?
I think it's best to be remove the not paying athletes, and I think you should be allowed the universities to compensate their athletes how they feel, especially the coaches. I know coaches and athletic directors, they agree that players should be paid. They don't say it publicly because they want to avoid the criticism that, you know, I'm receiving for saying this, but I think that they would definitely give the players more because they know some of the things the players have to go to. It's not necessarily agreed that the players want money. It's when they're wanting to do something that they're unable to do. So, for instance, I wanted to see my mother for Thanksgiving freshman year, but I couldn't get home. I couldn't afford a plane ticket.
And that's a story we hear a lot. Players not being able to afford food, not being able, as we heard there, to fly home to see mom on a holiday. Is that the kind of thing we're talking about, Zach?
Absolutely. And you see this all at all different schools. It's not just at Wisconsin. And it's even more pronounced at other schools that don't come from as many as fortunate backgrounds and environments that some of us have at Wisconsin. But it's just it's literally a summation of everything the NCAA stands for. They have millions of these teenagers who accept scholarships to chase their dream of fame and fortune at the price of absolute submission to the whims of an organization, the NCAA, that puts their interests dead last. And that's what Nigel just highlighted, is that it's time for the NCAA to truly open up their eyes. And in me and Nigel's ideal world, it most likely means that the NCAA needs to be blown up totally, because the NCAA has placed the commercial success above its responsibilities of protecting the academic integrity, health, and well-being of the college athlete, and it's not going to change anytime soon with the NCAA in charge.
We're talking about the issue of paying collegiate athletes. Zach Bohannon is with us. He was the captain of the 2014 UW-Madison men's basketball team. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should college athletes be paid, either paid to play or at least allowed to get compensation based on their name, their reputation, their sport outside of the university? How should it work? Do you think a college scholarship is enough of a payment for student athletes? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation now with Zach Bohannon, captain of the 2014 UW-Madison men's basketball team, talking about whether college athletes should be paid or allowed to get outside compensation for their contributions to the often lucrative business of college sports. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this idea? How should it work if there is a change? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. To your calls now. Jeremy is on the line in Ashland. Jeremy, hi.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Absolutely not. College students should not get paid to play the sport. And for one, it is a sport. They don't have to play the sport to go to school. Plus, they're, you know, 99% of them are already getting the college scholarships. So they're already getting school for free. So the sport is just a bonus. And on top of it all, you know, you got some of these great big high schools down in the southern part of the country, and even, you know, some up here in the north. If you're going to pay college students, you might as well pay high school students too. Where does it end?
Jeremy, thanks for the call. A lot of the arguments against that you heard there, Zach, including, hey, there's scholarships. You're getting some real value out of this.
Absolutely, and it's a common argument. It's, like I said, a straw man article at the end of the day. I appreciate Jeremy's response to our conversation. But at the end of the day, are you going to limit the compensation that is available for any student who's on scholarship, who has a hidden talent that they've worked their entire life for, or a skill set that they've created on the free market that they're not able to be taken advantage of? So you're saying, like I mentioned in my previous argument, that a college writer who's a college student who's on an English major, he can't profit or she can't profit off of a best-selling novel that they write, or an engineering student is not allowed to go make money off a patent he makes, then you got to make it all across the board. So I disagree with the premise of his basic response.
Jeremy, thanks for the call. Go next to Jim in Rice Lake. Jim, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me on. I think there was a time in the 50s, the 60s, maybe even to the 70s, when college sports weren't the multi-million, almost billion-dollar industry that it is. I think a percentage of the profits that go to the sport should be set aside for the players, particularly violent sports such as football, where we now know that concussion syndrome can lead to permanent, you know, harm and damage that students are not aware. Another thing that the last caller should understand is, for example, the professor of engineering doesn't make, you know, the chairman of the engineering department doesn't make multi-millions of dollars that the football coach does, and often the basketball coach does. This disparity between what the students are getting, the student athletes, and the coaches, in comparison even to the university president, shows a gross economic disparity and an inequality that should be addressed. And I'm not saying I have the best formula, but I think it's something that should be looked at. Thank you.
Jim, thanks for that call. And Zach, a related issue, people have pointed, a lot of these players, especially the low-income players coming to schools, are black. A lot of the coaches making six, seven-figure salaries are white. There's a racial division here, too.
Absolutely, and that's one of the biggest things that people don't like to look at. And Jim made a great point. A couple of them that I want to get into in a second, but you just made a great point in regards to the racial disparity. Taylor Branch, who's a civil rights historian who wrote some extensive research on the civil rights era, and I believe won a Pulitzer Prize of his writing, he wrote a piece called The Shame of College Sports in the Atlantic back in 2011, talking about the college sports scandal that's being taken place right now. And he talked about that the college sports has a whiff of the plantation. And Nigel Hayes has been outspoken about this as well. There's this big disparity between who's doing the majority of the labor. Up to 70% of college football and college basketball players are African-American, with the owners, per se, the coaches, the athletic directors, everyone else, the vast majority being white. and you're seeing this big pay discretion between the two, and Taylor Branch was the one who initially came out and said, talked about that dichotomy. With that said, going back to Jim's question, talking about the engineering professors and deans and whatnot, he makes a phenomenal point in regards to that, that why should the coaches have this insane salary, or athletic directors have these insane salaries compared to these professors or deans who are getting their salaries cut because of budget cuts within the school? And where exactly is all that money coming from? Quite frankly, the coach's base salary is in line with some of the professors and deans and whatnot at the university. But their money, the majority of it, and you saw with the recent scandal with Louisville's Rick Pitino, is Louisville actually gave upwards of 90% of the endorsement deal from Adidas to Rick Pitino's $7 million yearly salary. So $6 million is coming directly from the endorsement deal of the school, or of the school's marketing budget for Adidas, Nike, Under Armour, or so forth. One last point I want to make on that is that Bryce Jordan, the former Penn State president emeritus, asked Sonny Vaccaro back in the early 2000s, why should a university be an advertising medium for your industry? And that's where ultimately the money's coming from. And Sonny Vaccaro said, they shouldn't, sir. You sold your souls, and you're going to continue selling them. You can be very moral and righteous in asking me that question, but there's not one of you in this room that's going to turn down any of our money. You're going to take it, and I can only offer it to you. So these endorsement deals are only being offered, and the schools know that they're making up money for some of the lost revenue that they're making. So, Jim, very well done and great point.
Thanks for the call, Jim. We're talking to Zach Bohannon, former captain of the 2014 UW-Madison men's basketball team, about paying athletes in sports. Zach, with this endorsement idea, one worry might be, okay, you've got a handful of marquee players, and they're making a ton of money. And then you've got everybody else, and you know, maybe they get a local car dealership or something. I don't know. Is this going to create this huge imbalance among players?
Look, there's already a huge imbalance already. They already get the majority of the publicity, and you're already seeing on top of it, to take one step further, you're already seeing the imbalance of the pay right now. Now you're seeing all the money being included at the top with the coaches and the athletic directors and whatnot. Why shouldn't that endorsement deal be spread apart and split in a fair share or fair revenue model with the athletes who are actually the ones producing and wearing the endorsement brand and the medium that they're showing on the court and whatnot and on the field? So it's an outrageous argument to say anything differently.
And speaking of endorsements, Zach, I read a story you had. Briefly, could you tell us about it, where you were stopped from entering an arena because you had the wrong water bottle?
Yeah, this, I can go talk all day on this one specific issue, but we're getting ready to play against Arizona in the Elite Eight game before we made it to the Final Four, and we're in a pregame shoot-around that morning. And I walk into the arena, and the security is going through our bags and checking everything. And they're, granted, there's not one fan at the open or at the practice. If they close practice, we're just going in to get our shooting round with our team. Long story short, as the security guard, you can't bring that water bottle in, he says to me. And I was like, what are you talking about? He's like, you can't bring in that water bottle. That's not a registered sponsor of the NCAA. I was like, you got to be kidding me. And he's like, okay, you can sit up, you can stand out here all you want. You're not practicing. If you don't get rid of that water bottle, rip the label off, or give me the whole thing. I literally just laughed, and I made it as a joke and sent out a text or a tweet afterwards, and Jay Bills picked up on it, and a bunch of people just laughed and showed that such hypocrisy based on the NCAA standards that someone like me, who's getting stopped at the gate for not even being able to go into a close shoot-around because I didn't have the sponsored water bottle.
We'll leave it there for now, Zach. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
I appreciate it. Thanks again for your time.
We've been talking to Zach Bohannon. He was the captain of the 2014 UW-Madison men's basketball team. He is an advocate for compensation of one form or another for college athletes. There is still time for you to share your thoughts on this. Do you agree with him or not? How, if they did get paid, how should it work? You can share your thoughts. You can email ideas@wpr.org. You can also weigh in on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Here in the United States, we love our ranch dressing, and one company is giving us a chance to buy it by the keg. Hidden Valley is offering the ranch keg. Technically, you buy the keg empty, but it comes with a year's supply of ranch dressing to fill it up. Producer Chris Molina is our resident weird foodie at WPR. Hey, Chris.
Hi, Robin. I like that. That's my title now.
Yeah,
weird
it is.
Foodie.
I've actually gotten that approved. And it's the food that's weird. It's not you.
Right. And I've earned this title with all the stuff that I've brought in and fed you over the years.
Exactly. So a ranch keg.
A ranch keg. As far as I understand it, this is going to set you back $50. It has the year supply of ranch. I'm curious what constitutes a year supply of ranch.
It really depends on the person.
It's true. And it holds 5 liters of ranch, which we're assured that there's some special coating in the keg to make sure that that ranch is going to be good all year long. I'm just wondering what kind of weird situations this is going to lead to. Because I think of, you know, like your traditional keg, you've got people doing keg stands at certain parties. The ranch keg stand, the ranch pong, I think the possibilities are endless.
Right. This is smaller than a pony keg.
It's a small little keg. I mean, 5 liters, you're right, it's a little small thing, but man, it really takes the level of ranch to a new level.
And you being you, I asked if there's cool ranch Oreos on the horizon.
Hey, if there's not, it could be coming sometime in the near future. I think they've run out of all the obvious ideas for Oreos. They could be coming soon.
Thanks, Chris.
Thanks, Rob.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.